In case you haven't heard, it's officially an Abercrombie summer. The A&F Vacation Shop has everything on your packing mood board. I desperately need their new one piece, the A&F Marina. It's strapless, so flattering, and paired with denim shorts will be my go-to beach outfit this summer. Finally, your suitcase isn't complete without finding that dress. You know, the one for the photo shoot. Abercrombie's boho dresses have that perfect beachy romantic look. Make it an Abercrombie summer. Shop their newest arrivals in-store, online, and in the app.
Does it ever feel like you're a marketing professional just speaking into the void? Well, with LinkedIn ads, you can know you're reaching the right decision makers. You can even target buyers by job title, industry, company, seniority, skills. Wait, did I say job title yet? Get started today and see how you can avoid the void and reach the right buyers with LinkedIn ads. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next campaign. Get started at linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe, and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail, companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop, and hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest of my podcast this week is Ozan Unlu, founder and CEO of Edge Delta.
If you're at an early stage startup, look at how you're solving problems. Don't put more problems on other people's plate. Say, hey, you know, this is how I'm solving a problem. This is what I think is the best approach. And again, if people disagree with you, just make sure you're walking away and there's commitment. And we do this all the time, whether it's myself or someone else at the company, where you say, you know what, I disagree, but I'm committed. Let's go do it that way. And I think that's super important because, you know, again, when you're going and dealing with the companies that some of these companies make hundreds of millions of dollars in profits a day, right? Like, yeah. That is very hard to fight against if you aren't all in lockstep and marching forward.
This is Ozan. He has an unconventional career path that spans multiple disciplines. He started as a nanoscientist and researcher before transitioning into the tech world. His professional journey included roles at major tech companies. He worked as a software development lead and program manager at Microsoft and as a senior software architect at Sumo Logic. In September 2018, he founded Edge Delta after recognizing the need for a new approach to handling the exponential growth of data in modern organizations. And their mission? Change the way enterprises manage their data, particularly in mission-critical systems. And this inspired me, and hence I invited Ozan to my podcast. We explore what it takes to navigate the complexities of building a successful B2B SaaS company in a competitive landscape. He elaborates on his approach to solving mission-critical problems and building credibility in deep tech enterprise markets around a new category. Ozan also shares how he's maintaining a long-term vision while addressing urgent needs, and what he's doing differently to assemble and align a world-class team. Lastly, he discusses the challenges of market education, gaining early adopters, and scaling efficiently. And by listening to this podcast, you will learn four things. Firstly, what he learned from their rapid growth period, where they grew 6x in 1 year, and what he would do differently next time. Secondly, why he's saying no to companies like Apple, even though they might be able to help them. Thirdly, why he continues to focus on solving big technical problems rather than taking the easy route. And lastly, what he's done to build credibility and trust in the market. Well, hi, Ozan. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you, Tom, for having me.
Yeah, that's a pleasure. I've been doing my research about your company and it's It's a topic that, well, I mean, I told you before we started, I got a little bit on the wrong foot, because when I saw the first thing on your website, it was about pipeline. And I was like, okay, I know that stuff. Then I realized it wasn't about the pipeline I was thinking about. It was about data pipelines. So excited to have you on the call. Impressed with the growth that you've been going through over the last couple of years. So we're going to talk about that. But before we start talking about your company, Edge Delta, what drives you? What gives you energy as an entrepreneur?
I think, you know, we talk about this a lot at Edge Delta, where I really want the people that I work with to feel like they're at their best at Edge Delta. I want you to be the best version of yourself here. And so, you know, we do trust people. We give people a lot of responsibility. I think, you know, at a startup, probably most startups are giving people more responsibility than they really want to, just by nature of, you know, you want to be able to give people a lot of responsibility and a lot of weight on their shoulders. You also don't want to burn them out, and you want, you know, people to be focused on the right things. I think we've all seen when someone tries to do too much. But, you know, for me, what drives me is really, do I feel like when you join Edge Delta and the mission that we have, and we're all working hard for, you know, a combined product and go-to-market motion and everything else that kind of buy into that vision, are you at your best? And I really hope that, you know, the people that work here feel like they're at their best here. And I really hope that even whether it's people that move on or people that are about to join, I do believe and I hope that that's the same concept.
Kudos. I mean, I like that. And yeah, there's no shortcuts. There's no easy routes. Everybody has to do indeed to be their best, and hopefully all in the same direction, because then the company gets the velocity that you want. But yeah, I think that's the right mindset, rather than managing them to the most small task on their list. Good stuff. So yeah, bridging that then to the company, you founded it based on what I saw in September 2018. You had a long history, yeah, in various angles. We talk about that, I think, in a minute. One of them was Microsoft. When you started this company in 2018, what was a problem that you saw that was screaming for a solution?
Yeah, so, you know, early in my career, you know, I worked as a cancer researcher. I worked at Boeing. I worked at Microsoft. You know, so most recent of those three was Microsoft as a software developer. As a software developer, I worked on, you know, back-end server systems. I worked in the early days of the cloud and worked on the security team that handled all zero-day vulnerabilities across all Microsoft products. And so that was really a fantastic experience for effectively being able to be very deep in certain projects. But the challenge that you get at a very, very large organization like that, and obviously Microsoft's a great company, is a lot of what you learn isn't necessarily translatable to your next role. So, you know, I was learning more about, let's say, you know, GPUs and data centers. This was about 12, 13 years ago at this point, than anyone else in the world. But, you know, if you go translate to the next job, and at that point, it was far too early. I think, you know, Bitcoin technically was around, but, you know, not really being used. GPUs were only being used for pretty much video rendering. But if you go translate to your next role, probably 98% of my knowledge couldn't necessarily be directly translated for that next role. So when you're at a very large organization, you can go very deep, but you don't really have that same breadth. That was really a breath of fresh air when I decided to join Sumo Logic early in their journey as the first solution architect or sales engineer on the mid-market team. And this was going from, you know, working on one project very intimately for, you know, 9 to 12 months to all of a sudden I was working with hundreds and hundreds of organizations and companies out there and really understanding how do people work with their data. You know, in observability and security, we talk about, you know, logs, metrics, traces, events. These are all the various different data types. And so, you know, I went from being a developer to being a solution architect. In my later years at Sumo Logic, I went to what I call the dark side, which is a bag carrying sales rep. And so I kind of made that full transition. You know, now, for me, I was always about solving big technical problems. So I think our customers appreciated that. I think they appreciated that I was in there very hungry to solve big technical problems. And as a sales rep, that just meant that I made big commission checks. That was kind of a byproduct, but not necessarily the thing that drove me. Yeah. And so for the large, you know, seven-figure deals that I would land, I would always get a badge. So I'd always say, okay, you know, and you should give me a vendor badge. I would show up once a week. I'd bring, you know, whatever, pizza or sandwiches or whatever that day. And I'd really sit down with the customers and I'd start working with them on their queries. And what that allowed me to do is it allowed me to understand a gap in the market that it wasn't a limitation of for any want or desire or ability to do it. It was, there was a very real technical limitation and missing capability in the market. And that was really the origin of Edge Delta, where I said, okay, there is something here that no solution in the world has. And that really at its core is telemetry pipelines that allow you to do a lot more with your logs, metrics, traces, and events before it has to go to a downstream storage location where you can, you know, store for long-term retention. You could dashboard on it. You could search that data. You could alert on it. But really, it's that concept that before, with very small data sets, you can just send that all into a downstream destination. You can look at it later. It's not a big enough problem to necessarily optimize. But with the, you know, obviously the exponential rise and growth of data, it started to become a huge problem.
Just for the audience to understand, of course, I mean, nobody, not everybody is a specialist on observability and on data pipelines. But what were the kind of problems that these customers were, that woke them up at night, so to say? What were the business problems that they were seeing that couldn't be solved until this missing thing was there?
Absolutely. So if you look at, a lot of people ask me, for instance, who are your customers? Like, what verticals are you most successful in? And I wouldn't necessarily say it's a vertical, because we have, you know, airlines that are customers. We have large banks that are customers. We have gaming companies that are customers. We have pretty much every single type of business that would be a customer. But what I would say is any business where when your mission critical systems go down, it is wildly expensive for the business. That is a very, very, very important business to have observability and security really in place with real-time analytics. And so, you know, what that means is, for instance, you know, I was talking to a CIO the other day of a large coffee shop, for instance. And the person was saying, okay, well, you know, let's say our systems are down. Let's say you're unable to buy a cup of coffee. Well, you're going to go across the street and you're going to go try their coffee. And worst case scenario, you like their coffee better and you never come back. Best case scenario, you're going to come back tomorrow, but are you going to buy two cups of coffee tomorrow? No, you're just going to buy one cup of coffee tomorrow. And so I've lost that revenue forever, right?
True.
And she was saying, actually, certain businesses, like let's take Apple, for example, is not like that. Like if you think about Apple, if you're going to go buy a MacBook Pro and the Apple store is down or they're not able to take your payment, are you going to go buy some, you know, Lenovo Windows PC? No, probably not. Same thing with an iPhone, right? Instead of buying an iPhone, are you going to say, you know what? At this point, actually, I just decided I'm going to do an Android, right? Those are larger purchases. And for those purchases, Apple or, you know, whatever company might not necessarily lose a lot of that revenue, right? So there are certain businesses where when your mission critical systems go down, it's very easy for you to lose revenue. And many times you don't get that revenue back.
Let me make a small interruption here. Ozan just made an excellent remark about the criteria most important to his business to say qualify in or qualify out. Sure, they could help Apple. And this might very well be the dream logo to share on their website. But even Apple won't appreciate the value of their solution like others would do, and hence, they would never become a fan. The pain isn't of the same value and criticality. And that's a trait remarkable SaaS companies master. They realize that they cannot please everyone. Then they create something valuable and desirable, and aim to be different, not just better. And you can master these traits as well. The first step? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
So when you think about observability and security, and you know, we talk about a lot about mean time to identify or mean time to resolve issues, it's because of this exact thing. Some of these businesses are losing thousands of dollars per second. some of these businesses. You say, okay, well, if I'm a travel site and you're going to go book a flight and a hotel and a rental car and my website's down, you're just going to go to the other travel site and do it, right? Yeah. So I think, you know, that's the core for what we do is we ensure that for those large businesses, we can keep your mission critical systems up and running.
Fascinating value proposition to have. And specifically also how you solve it, because the whole thing at the end is not something that you do, that you easily create a system for, as far as I can see, by the way, but maybe I'm wrong there. So, okay, that's the problem. The opportunity, if you get it right, is indeed that mission critical systems don't go down and people don't lose a lot of money per second. Now going sort of rewinding back to when you started creating this, you said you were a software engineer, then you became a solution architect, then you went to sales, but then of course you started this company as a CEO. What has been an early decision that appeared to be really important for the success that you're seeing today? What did you do right at the start that was important?
I think, you know, in the first couple of months, I tried to put on my developer hat again. And, you know, for Microsoft standards, I was good. I was maybe an above average developer, but I was never a superstar, you know, for Microsoft standards or pretty much even for, you know, tech startup standards, right? And so I put on my developer hat. I kind of built out the MVP. But that's really when I approached my co-founder. I think you have to identify what are you the best in the world at and what should you probably try to have other people do if you want to be, as a company, the best in the world at something. And, you know, that was my co-founder, Fatih. He and I actually overlapped. We met when we were at Microsoft. And he was the best of the best, right? He was of the hundreds and thousands of developers at Microsoft, at least for the hundreds that I worked with, he was the best. He was incredibly good. If I ever actually even had a problem with my own software or my own projects that I was building, he was always kind of my go-to mentor. And I approached him and I said, look, I can build this thing to sort of work. You can build it to be enterprise scale. You know, I think when I approached him and tried to start convincing him, he, you know, he was at Twitter working on 50 petabyte systems at Twitter for a host of different things at that point. And, you know, that was a very critical, important point because that got started on a really solid foundation. If you think about it, you know, I talk about this a lot where you can be a startup that's, you know, building pens, or you could be a startup that's building spaceships, right? One of those, like pens, for instance, you better be profitable very quickly, right? If you're going to build something that's maybe not so differentiated or there's a lot of competition in the market and it's a known entity like a pen, then, you know, you have to have some angle and eke out some margins here and there. If you're building a spaceship, I would hope that any investor that invests in a company building spaceships is not expecting profits in the first year or even first couple of years, right? Mm-hmm. And so for us, we're really trying to change the foundation of how enterprises do their data. And so for us, it was really, really important for us to have a really solid foundation, bring in the top developers in the world, the top engineers in the world that can go build a phenomenal product that can scale and really get started there. So that was probably in the early days, a decision that I took to say, hey, you know what? Although I can be a developer, although I can write code, I want, you know, one of the best people in the world doing this. And, you know, unfortunately, that's not me. That's my co-founder.
Well, that's good. You know, it's again, it's knowing where you are at your best and certain things other people are. And that's fine. It's the same with, you know, certain customers fit and other customers don't fit. It's also fine. Go to the next one. You said a couple of interesting things here. Enterprise, change the foundation, how companies deal with their data. So for me, that sounds like, okay, you had to do a couple of hard things first. And your minimum viable product, I mean, I typically don't like the word minimum viable, but what does that mean then to create something that where customers say, this is what I've been waiting for, even if it's minimal?
I think if you look at, you know, if you're an investor, for instance, and you look at various different segments of types of businesses, you know, there's consumer, there's enterprise, there's B2B, there's deep tech, there's, you know, all sorts of various different kind of sub segments of these businesses. For us, we actually kind of happen to be at the intersection of enterprise and deep tech. And when you're at that intersection, you have to have a lot of patience, because there's no small little widget or little, you know, integration that you're going to go build to go help an enterprise when they're dealing with core issues of my data is growing at a rate of, you know, 50% year over year. And I don't know how to solve this. You're not going to kind of bolt something on top of that stack to solve that problem. So yeah, I think, you know, it does require a lot of patience to be able to build it the right way. You know, I'm here in downtown Seattle now, and there's some, you know, skyscrapers and whatever around me. You know, I think about this for the person, if they were going to go build the next skyscraper, do they want to trust a seed stage or a Series A company for the concrete? Right? Mm-hmm. Maybe not. And so I think, you know, if you're dealing with core foundational business problems, one of the biggest things you need to have as a startup is credibility. So where does credibility come from? It comes from not only your resume, comes from, you know, your product and how does it work during an evaluation. It comes from your existing customers. It comes from case studies. It comes from references. And I would say even today, that's still one of the largest things that we have to focus on is credibility for our business. If we're not credible, then how can we expect the Fortune 100 or Fortune 500 or Fortune 1000 companies to go build on our platform? And so, you know, that's a big thing that we take pretty seriously. We take privacy and security very seriously. We take, you know, availability very seriously. And so we want to enable our customers to be better. And that's the way we see it best done.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's not an easy task. So what has been the hardest nut to crack so far on that level?
Hardest nut to crack so far? I mean, I think, not to sound repetitive, but going back to the credibility aspect, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I think, you know, obviously there's the Microsofts and the Googles and the Amazons of the world with their kind of hyperscalers and their clouds. You know, if you think about it, right, why do most startups build on AWS? It's kind of like the safe known choice. You know, I would say probably five, and I used to be a developer in Azure, right? So I will say, like, 5 years ago, probably it was head and shoulders above the rest of the competition. Now, I think, you know, each individual hyperscaler probably does some things quite well, but it's a safe choice, right? If you're going to go build your SaaS service, are you going to do it on the 25th best cloud out there, right? And even if that cloud that was 25th largest was actually the best product, we're not going to know about it for maybe another 10 years, right? Because again, it's core underlying foundational. And so that's probably the hardest nut to crack, is to say there could be, you know, whatever, cloud service X out there, and cloud service X could be 10 times better than any other cloud service, but still their revenue wouldn't necessarily be growing that quickly in the early days, because the default choice might be AWS or Azure or GCP for those, you know, next generation startups. So that's probably the hardest part is yeah. how do you close that gap, and how do you get someone to understand, hey, Cloud Service X or Edge Delta is so much better than the alternative that you really need to consider this. And I think that's where, you know, not only is it a hard nut to crack, but once you do, it's also very invigorating.
Yeah. So my question would be then, can you give an anecdote about how you've been able to close that gap or to remove that credibility issue? Or is it still work in progress?
Yeah, I think in the early days, you kind of have to will your company through it, right? Everyone who's been through those early days, you know, there's the formula, there's what people tell you to do. But at the end of the day, you have to be the one to really push through and keep running into that brick wall over and over and over again. And at some point, you know, you'll break through it. For us, it was about getting those early customers and getting the trust with those early customers. And, you know, everything starts with a conversation. So even in the early days, in the first year, when we had a product that was very good at very specific things and had tons of other gaps, right? You know, we have to have that conversation. And just like you said earlier, some customers are ripe for that. Some customers are not ripe for that. But in the early days, you have a conversation. You see if your long-term vision is aligned with what that customer needs. And then you go from there. I would say that's probably the biggest thing to focus on early is, nobody in your first year, at least for, you know, any type of deep tech or enterprise product, nobody in your first year is going to look at it and say, this has absolutely everything we need.
No, of course.
You know, they look at your product and they say, Well, this has some of the things we need, and we love your vision, and we believe that you'll get there. So we will be an early adopter. And I think that is something that you continue to crack that nut over and over and over again. And you just have to put in the effort. You have to have that credibility with the customer, and you have to be a trusted advisor. So you really have to know your space. I advise a lot of startups, and I tell them, like, what about this area that you're trying to build a company? And do you know better than anyone else in the world? That's a really important concept and aspect for a startup. No investor wants to go put their money in if they can't get a good answer to that question. I think that's probably the hardest thing to crack. It's effort. It's really being that trusted advisor. It's being in a space that you really, really, truly, intimately know better than anyone else in the world. And it's really kind of pushing forward and being a visionary and innovating in that space instead of, you know, going in there and just saying, you know, hey, well, just give me a shot.
Exactly. I think the order also of how you put it there is very important, because at the end, you know, it starts small, but you need people that believe at that point in time, and you solve something for that is already a highly valuable and critical thing for them. So it's already good enough to get moving. But it's a lot about belief, and that's why there is this fantastic bell curve. It's the innovators. So when did the first version of the product come to market?
So we got our seed round of funding in 2019. So that was really where it started to take off. We were able to hire a lot more engineers in the early days. It's everyone talks about it's founder selling, right? You have a lot of engineers. You have a couple of founders that go out there and are passionate about what they're doing. And that's pretty much getting you, hopefully, to the Series A when you raise your Series A.
Well, you've done your Series A, and then you've also done a Series B. So clearly things happened there. That journey towards that moment whereby Series B also became possible. What have you learned there in terms of what helped you to get traction and to kind of to get momentum in the market?
I think really it's you have to be careful about not focusing only on short-term issues, right? There's stuff that's important for the business, and there's stuff that's urgent for the business. A lot of times in the early stages, it's difficult not to only focus on just the urgent stuff, right? Because if there's all these buyers everywhere, it is the more obvious thing to focus on. But the important things might not necessarily be urgent, and vice versa. So I think that is probably something that you have to continue to say, although we're having these fires that we want to fight, we always have to dedicate a certain amount of our resources and time and brain power to thinking about where we want to be in 3 to 5 years, what we want the product to do in 3 to 5 years, the problems that we want to be solving in 3 to 5 years. And so, you know, as your seed stage, it's all about scratching and clawing and being, a survivor. As you're in the Series B stage, it is quite different, right? The enterprises that are now adopting our platform, they ask that question. Like, where do you want to be in 3 years, in 5 years, and in 10 years? How can we contribute to that product roadmap? And so I would say that there is a drastic difference, and the things that you need to focus on do change, but you should always make sure you have that long-term mindset as well.
Do you use, you talked about it earlier on, making sure that everybody is at their best, that you give people trust and responsibility. Do you have a framework for that? Because typically what I, where it starts again is like, this is the vision. This is where we want to go. What is your framework then for people to make their own decisions that align with where you want to go?
I think it's important to believe that we make the best decisions we can with the information we have at the time, mm-hmm. right? Like, we're never going to be right all of the time. I think it's Ben Horowitz has this great quote where he talks about it's better to be inconsistent than wrong. If you're wrong, and I think he has some sort of military or battle analogy where, if the enemy is about to come over one hill and you're lined up for that hill, and then you get new information that the enemy is actually going to come over the other hill, you should probably reposition. And, the general or the person leading that group of soldiers or army shouldn't be too concerned about like, well, I was wrong. It's like, yeah, I know I was wrong. We have new information now, and we have to kind of reset. And I think that's important in that, you know, I think we do try to make the best decision we have. We can with the information we have at the time, but it's also important to understand that, hey, we can kind of do these little mini pivots in the way that we think about these small problems. And sometimes you have to transition the way you think about large problems. And I think that's true for leaders. I think that's true for ICs. And a lot of times you're the person with that information. So for instance, I might have different information given my role and who I'm speaking with and, you know, those type of conversations, just like an engineer might have different data about how, you know, some low level system operates and might say, okay, well, actually based on what I've seen, this is the right solution. So I think there is some space there. And, you know, to be mindful and to be aware that people have different data sets, you know, there also is this concept of beating the drum, right? As a CEO, as a startup CEO, you have to beat the drum. You might feel like you're being repetitive, but most of the time, other people that have heard it from you are only hearing it for the first time. And so, I think really being focused on that, really being, you know, ability to adapt and be agile, I think is super important.
Yeah. Do you have first principles in the company? I mean, I've had a couple of people on the podcast that have first principles, and they say, based on these two decisions, if they are yes as an answer, most of the time you should do it.
I mean, I think just on that note, it's important that if you're misaligned, we're definitely going to fail.
Yeah.
Right. And so we do have this concept of disagreeing and committing. And, you know, sometimes other people do it. Sometimes I do it. Sometimes my co-founder does it. Right. So whatever ends up happening, we can walk away from the meeting saying, okay, we're all aligned and we're all committed. That's perfect. That's ideal. You can walk away from the meeting saying, okay, I disagree with you, but I'm all on board to make this thing work. What's unacceptable or what you can't do is I'm going to walk away and either I have zero passion for this because I disagree with it, or, you know, I'm not going to work hard on this or whatever else. And all of a sudden, no matter what, as a startup, you're already fighting so many battles. You're definitely going to fail if that's the case, right? So I think that's probably from a decision standpoint, it's really important because, you know, a lot of times over the years, people could come to me and they might say, well, you know, we have this problem. It's like, great. Okay. So like, what do you propose? Well, I don't know. In that case, like, we have to do something. We have to keep moving forward. And so I think that's the key is, you know, especially if you're at an early stage startup, look at how you're solving problems. Don't put more problems on other people's plate. Say, hey, you know, this is how I'm solving a problem. This is what I think is the best approach. And again, if people disagree with you, just make sure you're walking away and there's commitment. And we do this all the time, whether it's myself or someone else at the company, where you say, you know what, I disagree, but I'm committed. Let's go do it that way. And I think that's super important because, you know, again, when you're going and dealing with the companies that some of these companies make hundreds of millions of dollars in profits a day, right? Like, yeah, that is very hard to fight against if you aren't all in lockstep and marching forward.
Exactly. I think you said the right words there. It's you need everybody. There's not enough resources. You need to be at your best making those decisions and move forward. And the moment you don't get that, everybody goes their own direction, thinking they are kind of hitting off their local targets or their silo targets or their departmental targets, company is going nowhere. Good point there. Let me see. You mentioned also about repositioning, and I'm day to day in the repositioning part. How important has the positioning and also the segmentation that you've been using, how important has it been as you move the company forward? Because I mean, you already mentioned earlier on that the solution can technically be used by every company, but the companies that are going to be your biggest fans are the ones where this is mission critical. So I think that is already a very big segmentation criteria. What else has been important in that positioning and segmentation game?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. You know, in the early days, I had this mentor when I was at Sumo Logic, and he said, well, you have to risk being too early for the market, because you damn well can't be too late, right? If you're too late for the market, you've already lost. And True. For us in the early days, I think we had our vision. I do think we were a little too early in the market. I think, you know, we are the first and only telemetry pipeline that allows you to do all the things that you'd want to do with your logs, metrics, traces, events. But for the first few years, we were educating the market. So a lot of people were showing up and they were just simply in awe of, you know, what are telemetry pipelines? What is this concept? Like, why can't I just use Splunk or Datadog, right? Like, that was very important for us to do at the time. I think where we're really excited is, you know, for the last couple of years, it's been the opposite. Now, the last couple of years, it's been people saying, no, I totally understand why we need this. Now we're just trying to understand, how are you better than XYZ solution, or how are you better than the platforms that we've been using for the last 10, 15, 20 years? So I think that educating of the market and creating a category, that has been probably the most transformational thing that I've seen in the last couple of years compared to the early days where, you know, again, you have to risk being too early for the market because you can't be too late.
Yeah. Did it start as something, okay, I want to create a new category, or did it just happen?
I think it was a new category. I mean, I had, you know, 15, 20 years experience in the industry dealing with monitoring and alerting systems and, you know, seeing it at very large companies, seeing it at very small companies. And so we understood at the beginning that we were creating a category. We understood that compared to the traditional architecture, if we think about it, you know, and again, I know that not every audience is here in observability, but if we think about it back in the day, it was effectively this concept that you would take your data and put it into a bucket, right? This same concept for business analytics or sales ops is the exact same thing, where you have your data in a bucket, you have some sort of query engine or data warehouse that queries that bucket. That's great at small data volumes. At small data volumes, you don't really need anything more sophisticated than that. And then probably about 10 years ago, streaming solutions like Kafka started getting very popular. And people started to say, okay, well, we have to put Kafka in front of that bucket of data. And the Kafka can effectively be this centralized pipe. And you can put some logic in that pipe. So you can say, maybe if data equals A, I want to put it in this bucket. If data equals B, I want to put it in this bucket, right?
Yeah.
And then from there, this was really the next iteration, right? So you have your data buckets, you have your pipelines, and then you have your distributed pipelines. You have your telemetry pipelines that deal with, okay, I don't have just one source of data, right? We're not a monolith anymore. We're not like a single giant server in a room. It's like, this is the cloud. This is, you know, microservices, Kubernetes, et cetera, right? So we have all these various different technologies and services and systems running all over the place, and they could be physically geolocated in different places. And all of those things are creating data. So now there's a third piece to the puzzle that was missing, and that was telemetry pipelines. So for us, I mean, technically, it made sense. Architecturally, it made sense. But it was, unfortunately, a new category that we had to go out there and create.
It's fascinating that you, of course, that you can start to connect the dots about what you see in the market and say, okay, well, this is the missing piece that we have to build at. I mean, every entrepreneur is always looking for that. The question at the end is, of course, it's also a choice, because what you say, there's no solution like it. It's a new category. Nobody is going to Google for it. Keywords don't exist. You invent them. If you do it again, if you start another startup, would you do it again? Or would you say, hey, wait a minute, I'll just take something and make something that's existing 10 times better?
I would do it again. I think, you know, us at Edge Delta, we're ambitious, right? We're audacious. We want to go solve big problems. You know, I think we have one life to live. So I think we all want to be out there taking our best shot. And for us, we feel really, really good about what we built and what we are building, right? Like, the solution is not perfect. No solution out there is perfect. So every single day we show up, we look at how can we improve? How can we be 1% better than we were yesterday? And that compounds over time. I think I would absolutely do it again. This is something that we're very passionate about. We have a lot of experience in. And every single new customer that we talk to, it's exciting, because no two businesses solve this problem in exactly the same way. So different businesses have different architectures. They have different needs. They have different reasons why they've done things the way that they've done them. And so, yeah, I think that's the exciting part. I would much rather be after a very large market solving very large problems than, you know, maybe taking the slightly easier route. I mean, none of these things are easy, but, you know, we choose to solve big technical problems.
Yeah, I mean, I always applaud for that. And what you say is right, you know, and that's also true in condensed markets, that no matter whether you've got the same type of functionality, the way you approach the problem will always be different. And that's your main sort of differentiation. And one way of solving it might be good for this type of customer, and another way is for another. But at the end, you can then clearly differentiate in your industry and build a moat around it. Let me see. I've got two questions left. What has been your biggest learning when it comes to creating efficient growth? Because, I mean, you've done the seed, you've done the Series A. At Series A, you start to see momentum. There's certain things that become repeatable. Series B at the end is really about scaling. What has been a main lesson that you've learned to get to that repeatability faster?
Yeah, I think we raised our seed round, and then this thing called COVID happened. And then, you know, we raised our A round. And then right as we're closing our B round, you know, the interest rates go up and the market kind of starts turning a little bit. So I think, you know, being able to be adaptable there, I think every startup in 22 had to look at how do we start being more efficient, right? There was really kind of this concept of, you know, burn money as fast as you can get it for growth at all costs. And that turned to, well, yeah, we want startups to be growing, but we want them to be doing it the right way. I know even on this show, right? You have a lot of founders that come on that have bootstrapped, right? Yeah. And I think actually funded startups are probably as close to bootstrap companies now than at any point in the last, you know, I don't know how many years. And so I think that's the exciting part is looking at, okay, how do we slow down a little bit? How do we stop the explosive growth? I think at one point we had 6x'd the number of employees in the company in 1 year. So, you know, that was a very unnatural growth. And the problem is it kind of double hits you. Not only do you have people that are joining the business that don't understand it yet just because they haven't been able to be there for long enough, but you also have all the people that have been there for long enough not really working. I mean, they're working their butts off, but they're, you know, interviewing, they're recruiting, they're trying to figure out, you know, onboarding, they're training. So like it kind of not only slows you down from that perspective, the burn rate goes way up, but you know, also you're getting less done from the core work. And so that was probably the biggest learning experience is, you know, I remember my co-founder Fatih looked at me one day and he's like, never again are we gonna do 6x growth in a year. It's just unnatural. It's not, you know, sustainable. And so yeah, I would say that's you know, probably the good thing about this market that we're in today is, you know, most companies don't have to go through that, right? Because that's not a very natural thing to go, you know, increase the size of your company by whatever 500% or 600% in a given year. And so, I think that's the biggest learning experience is stay efficient, stay true to what feels right. If you're hiring and it feels unnatural because you're hiring too fast and it's chaotic, probably is. You know, and on the flip side, you also always want to be hiring, right? Like even if you're not experiencing growth necessarily, it's really important to bring in people that have new perspectives and new understanding of the space, and really be able to support that. So, you know, find a way, whichever way you can, you never really want to be in, you know, too big of a hiring freeze, so to speak. But yeah, I think the days of 6xing in 1 year, we'll see if they come back in the next few years here, but I don't see them today.
On that trajectory towards profitability, I mean, have you become profitable in the meantime?
No, I mean, I think for us, again, going back to the analogy of the pens and the spaceships, right? Yeah. We're a lot closer to the spaceship company than the pen company. And so for us, you know, we're reinvesting into R&D. You know, a large part of our company is R&D. So that's by far the largest organization in the company. So, you know, sometimes I look at businesses out there where they have a few engineers and a really large sales force and they can be profitable pretty quickly. You know, for us, we focus on innovation and we're focused on the long term. So that wouldn't be necessarily natural for us. But, you know, one day.
Exactly. No. I mean, that has to happen at some point in time. And like you say, you have to build that infrastructure part first. Yeah, that just takes a lot of hands. Even there's generative AI these days. We talk about that for hours. Last question here. From the lessons that you've learned, possibly taking some from the engineer to the sales and then to become the CEO. By the way, I saw that you've been voted 24 CEO of the Year by GeekWire. So congratulations with that.
Thank you.
What,
thank you.
What is a piece of wisdom that you can share with other tech entrepreneurs? Maybe a do and a don't.
A do and a don't. I would say don't start building too early. I mean, it's hard. And you mentioned ChatGPT, right? I think really understand what the problem is. It's very easy to build a prototype, but don't go too far without reassessing. I think you hear about a lot of these startups in the early days where they're like, well, the first project that we did, it took us, you know, the first 4 weeks. And when you're in it, it feels like an eternity, right? You think, oh my gosh, like I don't want to throw away 4 weeks of work, but that could be, that's a sunk cost and that's something that maybe you should walk away from. So I would say in the early days, don't be afraid to change the idea pretty quickly. If you talk to a lot of investors, they say that, right? They're like, look, we're betting on the team and we're betting on the market. The idea might change and the idea probably should change in the early days. Yeah. And so that's probably both the do and the don't is, don't focus and really have tunnel vision on the original solution. If you do start getting data points back from the field or whatever else, then, certainly don't be afraid to also pivot and try a different idea. For us, I mean, we did that a few times in the early days. We had some concepts. Some things were disproven. Some things were kind of aha moments for us. And those are important in the early days. And then finally, probably on that last point, don't take any one person's word as gospel, whether it's an investor or a customer or a prospect or an employer or whatever else, right? Every single person's advice and opinions are all data points, myself included. Don't take anything I said today as gospel, right? Take it as one data point. Say, okay, well, Ozan said that. And then I also heard, Tim and John and Sally all validate that. So yeah, if they all agree on the same thing, it's probably correct. If there's disagreement, there could be lots of reasons for that. But, take advice and mentorship from everyone as individual data points. And then you have to draw your correlation. You have to draw your line to what you believe is correct, given that those data points. That's probably the number one most important thing as well. I think we have a tendency sometimes if we're going and trying to pitch for a seed round of funding or for a Series A, an investor gives feedback and says, well, the way I look at it, XYZ, I think you should be doing this differently. That might be right. That might be wrong, but it's one data point. And I think, that's important to keep in mind is don't over-rotate too much on an individual data point.
Strong point. Completely agree with that. Yeah. Sometimes it's encouraging to say, I found it. Great, great idea. I'm going to try that. But do another round of validation. So thank you very much for sharing the wisdom. Fascinating how you've been growing the company so far. Where can people go to find out more about Edge Delta or to say hi to you?
Yeah, you can find me on LinkedIn. So my name is Ozan Unlu, OZANUNLU. Also, edgedelta.com, just like it sounds, edgedelta.com. If you're in a large enterprise, if you use systems like Splunk, Elastic, Datadog, New Relic, you probably know our space quite well. So feel free to go to the website. Feel free to send me a message on LinkedIn. My door is always open.
Thank you. Well, a pleasure talking to you.
Okay. Thank you so much.
And this ends my conversation with Ozan. And I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Ozan Unlu, founder and CEO of Edge Delta. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.